When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So you're going to Lala this year, right, Lindsay?
I actually think this might be the first year in almost like a decade that I'm not going.
Decade. You've been going since you were 11.
Well, I think I've been going for like 7 years in a row.
You played the Kids Rock stage at noon on the Sunday date of 2003.
The day I turned 13, I was like, I don't want a bat mitzvah, mom and dad. I want to go to Lala.
I just want to be in School of Rock.
No, I really do. I think this would have been like my 7th or 8th year. But the Oshiega lineup, I think it's in Montreal, is actually rivaling Lollapalooza for me. So I might switch it up a little bit and try that instead.
What's going on in Oshiega?
I believe it's Florence and the Machine, Arctic Monkeys, who will also be at Lollapalooza. And I can't remember. It's escaping me right now. But the lineup is just a little more different. The experience would be a little more different. So I might be swayed.
Is it one of those bilingual festivals where, because of local Canadian arts ordinances, a certain percentage of the performers have to be singing in French?
Is that even a real thing?
They do that on Canadian radio.
Really?
On like public Canadian radio and college radio.
I had no idea. I wonder if that is carried over into the festivals. I'm not sure.
Well, if you hear Alex Turner singing in French, that's Oof. Why.
I think I'd
Too
pass
hot.
Out soon after. I actually spoke to him recently.
Oh, how was he?
It was great. That was like a bucket list interview for me, for sure. And I think whenever you do an interview like that, all you can really hope for is that they're nice and, you know, like forthcoming in their responses. And he definitely was. He's very big on obscure references, and I had to do a lot of side Googling. But yeah, it was a great conversation, and the album is super good, very different, and I think it will surprise people, but in a good way.
Ooh, Lindsay Haven's just dropping teasers for what's to come.
Oh, yeah.
When can we expect that?
I believe the album is out May 11th.
Well, when can we expect the interview?
Ah, even sooner. The interview's coming out in the next issue of the magazine, so on this Thursday, actually. Yeah. I don't know when this podcast is going to post, but
on this is Thursday.
Oh,
this is
wow.
Thursday. That issue,
you guys,
right now. That's the same. That's the same issue with my Paramore interview, right?
Yeah,
it's the same. Oh yeah, this.
See, Payne and I are just
there. We go. There we go.
Interviewing all our faves.
Yeah. So this week's podcast is another Meet Me in the Bathroom inspired episode. I'm talking about Lizzie Goodman's fantastic early 2000s rock and roll in New York City history book. Last week, we had Albert Hammond Jr. of The Strokes on. This week, it's another legend of the early 2000s, even late 90s NYC rock scene. It's Walter Martin, who played the organ in a seminal band. If you read the book, this band really did kickstart really the root of the whole thing before The Strokes. A band called Jonathan Fire Eater, which I just sort of learned all about them from the book. They were before my time, kind of slipped by. I was really into his later band, The Walkmen, we talked about a lot. Love The Walkmen. Walter was a great interview, and what you'll hear more about. My favorite takeaway from this interview was, dude was in a band before Fire Eater called the Ignobles, this kind of grade school aged ska bands, and they opened for Lenny Kravitz on his very first tour, and also Fugazi.
What?
Lenny Kravitz and Fugazi when this dude was like 13.
I can't even imagine.
And he's just, I mean, like, I don't know what you say about that when you're like older and looking back on it, but he was just like, yeah, that's a thing that happened.
Wow. And here he is now.
Here he is now. This was really fun. He has several solo albums out since The Walkman went on hiatus. This is a track off of his most recent solo album called Reminisce Bar and Grill. Came out earlier this year. This is the very funny barbershop quartet inspired. Went on a solo Australian tour.
I went alone on a solo Australian tour. What'd you do that for? 'Cause it'd been a while since I'd been out to see the world. But it's so far away. Yeah, that's true, but long trips are good for me. What are they good for? 'Cause I need time alone to organize my dreams. What did you see there? Saw some nice folks and some sunny cities too. Who did you meet there? I met a guy who'd been punched in the face by a kangaroo. It's true. On earth that happened down here.
Yeah, I've been reading Meet Me in the Bathroom lately.
Oh, yeah.
And,
I actually haven't read it. I read the excerpts that are online.
Okay.
I don't know why I haven't read it. It's weird. It's like a block. Somebody else asked me why I hadn't read it. I was like, I don't know. It's like a block. But I did enjoy reading the excerpts online.
Mm-hmm.
And they were. It was nice to hear people talk favorably about Jonathan Fire Eater. That always makes me feel good.
Yeah, it's cool because I mean I knew. I'm a big fan of the Walkman,
uh-huh.
So I always knew that Jonathan Fire Eater was a thing, but I had no idea of just like the impact because it was before my time and everything, but
uh-huh.
It was crazy to read all about that opening the book.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a long time ago. That was like, I mean, that band started like with, you know, when we were like, I mean, I think of it as starting when I was like 12 because Stuart, the singer, and I started doing it when we were 12, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like doing guitar lessons and playing like concerts and stuff like that.
Were you like could you shred back then? Were you good?
No. We took classical guitar lessons. I don't know why. It was the only guitar lessons that were offered at our school. So like nylon string classical guitar, learning like, you know, fingering patterns and stuff like that. Not really chords. So we sort of just, you made like crude chords, like just barring all the way across, you know, just sort of rhythm. We were playing like, we covered Should I Stay or Should I Go, I remember.
Okay, that's a nice simple one.
For this girl's birthday party. So it was like, ba-na-na-na-na-na-na. You know, it wasn't like doing the chords. You're sort of, but you know, we were trying.
Yeah. So around that time, you opened on Lenny Kravitz's first tour?
that was when we were like in 10th grade, I think, or 9th grade? 10th grade, I guess. We played, it was me and Matt and Paul, who were all in the Walkman, and Stuart, who was in Jonathan Fire Eater, was a singer. He played bass, and we had another singer who's a friend of ours. And we played like ska. We were really into like the Specials, you know, like
okay.
Obsessively. So we played ska, you know, and we were pretty good because we just could kind of do it. And we were all pretty small, you know. I was actually a little bit taller, but the other guys were very small dudes, so they looked like they're about, you know, 9 or 10 years old. And so we started playing like at the 9:30 club. The old 9:30 club in DC, thinking that we were like really cool. But I think people just thought that we were, I think the bookers was like a novelty. We didn't realize at the time it was like a novelty thing.
It was like having School of Rock there.
Right. Because we did look very young. We could play. We had like rhythm and playing ska and we were wearing like black sunglasses and like sort of pork pie hats and stuff like that. So we thought it was like totally badass, but it was definitely like a novelty act. It took me a long time. I think I was like 30 when I realized. I was like, hold on. We were like a fucking novelty act. but yeah, so we opened for like Lenny Kravitz. It was the first time I'd ever heard of him. We opened for him on his Let Love Rule tour. And we opened for like the Selector, which is a ska band that we idolized. And we opened for a lot of people at the old 930 Club, like Fugazi. And like,
you opened for Fugazi?
We did. I don't know if we opened for them at the 930 Club. We opened for them at this place called Summer Stage. Called Summer Stage. No, that's not called Summer Stage. It's called Fort Reno, which is like an outdoor concert series in the summers. So Soul Side, which is an early incarnation of Girls Against Boys. It was us. We were called the Ignobles. It was Ignobles, Soul Side, and Fugazi, which is a great summer evening.
What year was this to start off?
That would have been like... like 90.
Wow,
probably.
That's like 91. Core Fugazi. That's when they did like 13 songs, right?
Yeah. Maybe it was 92. Yeah, I was probably like sophomore, so it's probably 91, 92.
What was that show like?
Great. You know, it was amazing that we got it. It was cool. It was outdoors, so you know, it's like broad daylight, and like our parents were there, and like, you know. I can't remember if it felt like a huge deal. I think it probably kind of felt like a big deal. It was more like bragging rights. I don't know.
Sure.
We do have pictures of that show, I think. We're all like modded out, you know, and have I was playing guitar at the time. I think I had a sticker that said Rasta on my guitar.
Okay. Yeah, I can see how looking back on that, it's many times more unbelievable than it would have been in the moment when you were just a kid, just taking things as they come, playing with your friends.
Right.
Just like, yeah, we're playing with these bands.
Yeah, and we would always forget to get paid. I remember it would be like 2 weeks later, we'd be like at school, and Stu, my friend, and I'd be talking, and be like, we never fucking got paid. We used to forget that you're actually supposed to get paid for this stuff. So we'd call the 930 Club, this nice woman, Lisa White, who had booked us, be like, hey, yeah, we actually played there like 3.5 weeks ago and forgot to get our 50 bucks or whatever, and she would always like pay us. It was nice.
Sure. And like, I think we got a nice rhythm here. Let's just like take this chronologically and take us to the present day. I'm interested to hear this. So tell me how this ska band transformed into Jonathan the Fire Eater.
Well, we continued. We sort of got off ska a little bit, though. I think we played ska until like we were seniors. But we started playing some really bad stuff. Paul Maroon, who was a guitar player at Walkman, joined us in ninth grade. And we became a little more sophisticated then. We became like, we were playing like really shitty music though. We were playing like funk and stuff like that. We got into like the Red Hot Chili Peppers in a bad way. So we played a lot of that kind of stuff. And then, we did a lot of shows. We rehearsed a lot. We played like all the school dances, and we played at like, we played at the 930 Club, I'd say, you know, every couple months or something like that. They would just call us and we'd play some weirdo show opening for somebody. And when it was a different singer, and Stuart, who was the singer of Fire Eater, was the bass man. And then at the end of our senior year, we started doing stuff with me and Matt and Paul, and with Stu singing. And it felt really cool. It felt like great. We were like, this is actually really awesome. By that point, we had better taste in music. We were, you know, it was very much like Velvet. We're always sort of Rolling Stones-y kind of Beatles, classic rock guys. But then, like, I'd say junior, senior year, I got more, like, Velvet Underground and stuff like that. And so I think that, at least in my mind, I was like, okay, this is kind of like the Velvet Underground. This is, like, really cool and, like, kind of dark. And so we started doing that. We did a few shows at, like, friends' parties and stuff like that with Stu singing and me and Matt and Paul backing him up. And it felt really cool. I was like, this is great. And then we all went off to college. I went to Colorado, but I was only there for like a semester, and then everybody else was in college in New York. I thought I didn't want to do the band for a little while, and then as soon as I got to Colorado, I was like, what the fuck am I doing here? I want to do the band. So I immediately applied to go to school in New York and was there by the second semester, and then that's when Fire Eater really formed. And our good friend Tom, who was a good friend of Paul's in high school, Paul's actually a year older than me and Stu and Matt. Paul was very good friends with Tom, and Tom is a great musician. He can play anything. He's a classically trained pianist and stuff like that. He became the bass man, even though was never a bass man at all. I think like most bass men, he never really was. But he was a great enthusiast and a really smart guy and a great musician. So that became Fire Eater, and we started playing in New York. We all dropped out of college after a year. And so this August of 94, moved to Lower East Side, like all five of us living in like a shitty apartment, and started doing it.
There were a lot of drugs around, at least outside the apartment, right?
Yes, there were. Yeah, it was like, you know, it was about a month. We lived on Suffolk Street between Houston and Stanton. And about a month after, you know, our parents were not excited about the idea of us dropping out of school. So it was tough, you know. Just like I have great relations with my parents now, and I have for many years. But then it was tricky because they did not get it at all. As I probably wouldn't have. If my daughters did something like that, I would not be happy either. Anyway, about a month after we moved to Suffolk Street, there was a big article in the New York Times about how Clinton and Stanton, which was like a block from us or two blocks from us, was the heroin capital of the country. And so that didn't go over very well. There were drugs everywhere. It was, you know, it was gross. It was like a two block walk to our rehearsal space. And you, right when you walk out the door, there are junkies and stuff, and there are people offering you heroin, different kinds of heroin. You know, you get mugged. I never got mugged, but I remember Tom got mugged by a junkie on the way home. It was a different thing. You go to the Lower East Side now, and it's, you know, it's very different. But I remember back then, you hear old guys talk about, like, how, oh, so different back in the 70s. You're like, who gives a shit? But anyway, it was very different. It was very seedy, but you know, we were 19, so it was thrilling. You know, not that drugs were thrilling, because we weren't doing them. Well, not all of us were doing them. It was thrilling. You could drink beer on the street, so we just sat around. You know, we had a stoop, different stoops that we go to, and we just drink 22s of Country Club malt liquor every single night.
So tell me about some of the early shows, because I heard so much about, like, Stewart, what kind of a charismatic and alluring frontman he was, and just like the energy you guys had. Like, what was it like?
We rehearsed a lot. We rehearsed like every night, I feel like. Worked, you know, right when we got there, we recorded an album because we had a bunch of songs written. So, like, we didn't have a place to live yet. We were staying at friends who went to Columbia. We recorded like a 12-song record, 10-song record. We started doing shows and I worked at Kim's Video, like, and so we could have like sell Fire Eater CDs at Kim's Video on Avenue A. Sort of cool people became a little bit aware of like our stuff, you know? And people started coming to our shows, mostly like band people, you know, people older guys, like this band Railroad Jerk at the time. I'm actually still friends with Marcellus. He actually is an illustrator and works on the stuff I do. They were really good. They were a few years older than us, so we sort of looked up to them. And there was this band, the Chrome Cranks, who were older than us too, and just people who are sort of into like the Cramps, you know, and that kind of music. And that was sort of like the, you know, the thing is like, if you're into the Cramps, then like you're part of our deal. And so we had like some of those kinds of people coming to our show, and I guess they just told their friends. So it became sort of it became sort of a thing that people were coming to.
Yeah, and there was a big bidding war around you guys.
Yeah, that took a little while. I mean, we put out an EP. After we put out our first record, we put out like an EP. That was very small time. But we had like a professional photographer take our picture, which we were kind of like, we felt like we'd kind of made it. Mm-hmm. Then like all the labels for some reason started coming to see us play. And so that's when we got flown out to California and like, went to all the labels. I remember actually I was so excited to go out there, I just forgot my luggage. I like straight up just went to the airport without my luggage. And you know, it was fun. I was 19, or I guess I was 20 at that point, and it was very fun. We got to call our parents and be like, we're getting offered like a huge record deal with dental insurance, so like maybe we're not that stupid. And so that felt good, and our parents were kind of like, oh, okay, they're actually working and being serious about this. That sort of was nice to have a little bit of a peace on that front. It was, you know, we went to all the different labels and they were really, I don't know what they saw, because we never had like hit kind of stuff. You know, it was different. There were people throwing money at bands. And I think they thought we were going to be like Smash Mouth or something. You know, that band.
Yeah, I know Smash Mouth. just like Jonathan Fiery.
Because they had, well, because they had an organ, you know, and they had like, bom, 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 and sort of had like slightly 50s okay. influence kind of stuff. Even though we didn't really, I don't know. That was always our theory. Was like, okay, they think we're going to be like Smash Mouth, but we definitely were not going to be like Smash Mouth.
Well,
so yeah, it was fun. We were just like, you know, we were just drunk all the time, and it was really fun.
What were some of the things the record label people would do to woo you guys when they wined and dined you?
I mean, they just put us up in fancy restaurants and put us up in fancy hotels and took us out to fancy restaurants. And like, I remember this one guy saying that he would walk across the Gobi Desert to sign us. Literally, he said that. That was in New York at CBGB's. I was like, wow, I'm flattered.
Makes me think of that Smash Mouth song, You Might As Well Be Walking on the Sun.
Yeah, that was their hit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very comical to us. We thought it was really... We were obviously excited that something good was going to come out of it, but the process was, like, so comical.
Mm-hmm.
Just because we're sort of... I don't know. We all have a sense of humor, so it was very, you know... Honestly, at all these lunches and things, we're always hungover. So we were just, like, felt like schoolboys. We had, like, the giggles, and it was just, like, ridiculous. And our manager was this wonderful but very sort of absurd guy that people just in the industry could not get their head around. So it was this... It was just, like, comical.
Mm-hmm. We'll drop in some music so that people can hear. What do you think is a good song to represent what we're talking about here?
I like the song When Prince Was a Kid. I'm proud of that one. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, you play the organs. I love the sound of the organs and the keys on those albums.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it was a farfisa.
Close enough.
Yeah, farfisa organ. Yeah. No, it's a kind of organ. The sun out back to the underground. Set the stage now for the brand new love I found.
To kind of put a bow on Fire Eater, like how would you describe what ended the band and what moved you onto the Walkman?
Well, we started struggling internally because Stuart, who is was my best friend that, you know, growing up my whole life essentially, we just sort of grew apart and it hurt the band a lot. And so it ended up being that the four musicians were playing, rehearsing by ourselves all the time, writing so much instrumental music, and Stu was not coming to rehearsal. Stu and I are on great terms now, and he's a very dear friend. It fucked it up a lot. And so we, you know, we got signed to the major label, and we didn't really have the team was not like full force. So it didn't really work. I think we spent too much time on the music probably, and then Stu spent too much time trying to sing over. It just didn't, the album, I don't love that album we made. It was called Wolf Songs for Lambs. We spent a lot of time on it. There are moments on it that I like, but it's pretty, it doesn't really have much magic to it. Though I really am very, very proud of everything we did before that. And then, yeah, it just became, bad. We were not productive, and... We had like a 3-record deal, so we could have really milked the label and just like kept getting money. But we honestly didn't even realize that, and unfortunately our manager didn't really either. So we just like broke up, severed ties with the label, and called it quits.
Yeah, for the Walkman, looking back, do you have a favorite Walkman album?
Favorite Walkman album probably is probably Bows and Arrows. I think.
Okay.
I think we were doing pretty well then.
Yeah, I mean, that was the one that had the rat on it. Probably now, like, the most recognizable songs for the casual fans.
Yeah.
Your hit, so to speak.
It's our hit, for sure.
Walkman is... The Rat is such a great song.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. What was it like writing that song? Like, take me through your process.
I remember it very well. I remember we were... It was right after we did our first record, and Paul had the guitar part, came in with the guitar part to our old studio, Marcata, and it was like, and I had it just, Ham was like, I'm going to try singing Help, the Beatles song, on top of it. And then I had the idea to, I'd been obsessed with like Joy Division.
Okay.
And their Peel sessions. And they have this version of, what's it called? Transmission, which has, at the end of every round, he goes, and so I wanted to try putting that beat on it with that crazy fill. And so we just tried it, and Ham was singing Help, I think. And we're like, wow, this is fucking awesome. And it took us, we finished that part of it pretty quickly, which is just the verse. You know, the verse is kind of like the chorus in that song. Because it just sort of like a, it's like a cycle. And then we had all sorts of, we couldn't end it. We always struggled with ending. So we had all sorts of, we had like a key change and an like a really shitty ending for a while. And it was just so unsatisfying. And because then we finally figured out how to do our key change and get back to the main verse. And once we did that, we were like, okay, we're done. We're good.
Yeah.
But we were very proud of that song. I'm still proud of that song, just how extreme it was and how, you know, nasty it sounded, and just how minor it's like. We felt very cool playing that song.
So as the albums went on with the Walkman, you started to take on more of a songwriting and lyric writing role, right?
Yeah, after that record, we sort of, we did like that 100 Miles Off record, which was kind of like, it was right when all the guys, I never moved to Philly, but Matt and Paul and Pete all moved to Philly. And so it was during that period when we did that 100 Miles Off record. I think we wanted to like kick ass. We were trying to really kick ass still, but we weren't like rehearsing all together. So like Ham and I were writing in New York, and sometimes going down to Philly, and just sort of pieced together, you know. And we were, really wanted to still kick ass, so that's why we had those like shitty hardcore songs and like, I don't know. It was a transitional phase for us. So I think when that record came out, we were kind of realized that we weren't very into it, and that we were kind of like sort of, we were feeling, it was definitely a low. We don't know what we're, you know, are we really going to keep doing this? Because it didn't feel great. And then we started doing more, honestly, in my mind, it was when we started writing songs in 6/8. And it was Paul who pushed that. One of the first ones we did was, I guess, In the New Year. Even though it kind of rocks, it is 6/8. Mm-hmm. And it was just a different... Because I do a lot of like the drum stuff too, and so I was always like, when he first started playing 6/8, because Paul and I spent a lot of time with him playing guitar and me playing drums and coming up with parts, and I just couldn't. It just felt weird, you know. It felt like we're not rocking and rolling, and it took me a while to get used to it. And then I started really loving it, and like actually the beat for what's it called, In the New Year, I was like, okay, this is like kind of rocking and rolling, but it's also 6/8. And so then, you know, it changes like the way the lyrics sound and the way the singing rhythm is, and it really is a different thing. You're not kicking ass in the same way, even though we had done slow songs before. So we did a lot of 6/8 on that You and Me record. Yeah, and Ham and I started doing the lyrics together. We decided that we wanted to really focus on making the lyrics, you know, spending as much time on them as we did on the music. Just sort of, we felt like if we're not going to be so like just nasty kick-ass rock and roll, that we need to have a different kind of, you know, content, like substance in there. So we felt like we should make the lyrics substantial. And so we started really working on the words. And we did that for all of You and Me, and for, in Lisbon, we really worked on the words too. Then our last record, we worked on the words, but we were a little misguided at that point.
Were you guys starting to think about what was next at that point?
Yeah, we were a little frustrated by the time we did Heaven, because we, you know, I it's funny looking back at it now. It really seems like it feels like, I think people think we were like a big band, you know, or like a really successful band. And I think we, you know, we did fine. We did well. But we always, there were very few moments when we, the five of us would feel like we were not just like struggling. It really felt like a struggle. Just because we had five of us, we split everything equally. There, you know, a lot of time we're living in New York, it's expensive. And it's, you know, it's hard to stay afloat. So we always felt a little bit like we were struggling. We got good reviews, which made us feel good. We could draw a crowd, but like not like, we weren't like ever like, we're kicking ass, you know? And it was never like high fives. We had always joked. It was just, we thought it was funny, kind of. At least we told ourselves we thought it was funny. By the time like we did Lisbon, we were very proud of it, you know, and we really worked on it. And it didn't help us that much. It's just, you know, some of the guys had, I didn't have kids at that point, but if I had kids at that point, I probably would have been like, get me the hell out of here, about the band. So people were getting, there was definitely like, we got to either really make this happen or like make this not happen anymore. So yeah, we did Heaven, and we kind of, you know, we hired Phil Eck, who produced Fleet Foxes, that they're amazing records, and who's a great producer, just to sort of see what it was like to have somebody in charge, helping us, you know, because a lot of times we recorded ourselves, you know, and it can be very limiting. We wanted it to sound perfect and to sound like, you know, big and professional. We always felt like our stuff didn't sound professional. that was a big word for us. Like, yeah, it just doesn't sound very professional. And our girlfriends and wives would be like, yeah, it just sounds like sort of fuzzy. I remember my wife saying that so many times. She's like, sounds like you have like earmuffs on when you're listening to it. And I was like, yeah, I know. I don't know what it is. So we wanted to like eliminate that. We got Phil Eck to produce it. And then we wanted to have a single. So that's when we wrote like some really shitty songs, where we'd have like, it was definitely a conscious decision because I was doing all of the drum stuff. I was like, we're going to put snare on the 2 and 4. And we're going to have every chorus is going to have the same lyric repeated, which is, you know, pretty basic stuff.
Are you talking shit on some of the songs that made it onto the final album?
Yeah, I probably will. I mean, I think all the guys in the band would agree.
Really?
Well, I mean, you know, but there's some of them that I really like the title track. But there's some of it that like we didn't have our hearts into. We were trying to like, you know. We were trying to be, I don't know how much, I think if you ask any of the five of us about that record, I don't think there's tons of love for it. It wasn't as hands-on because we sort of passed it over to Phil to take over. So when it wasn't like, you know, that song Heaven, people liked that song. And I actually loved the video for that song, which had a lot of old pictures of us. Growing up as musicians, and I thought that really captured the spirit of the Walkman very well, because it's very like nostalgic and sappy, and we all are very much like that. And I really liked that video, I thought that was a good way for us to end. So after that, we were just like, yeah, let's like just not make another record.
Was there a moment where you decided to put the Walkman on hiatus, or was it more just a gradual thing?
Well, we finished the touring. I had my first child right during the tail end of the Heaven tour, and I, from my perspective, I just felt like I didn't want to, like, cause we toured a lot, you know, and I toured with the old band too, like, and it was, I just didn't want to go on tour anymore, especially with a kid at home. It sounded like the last thing in the world I wanted to do. So Ham and I, you know, at this point, only Ham and I are the only ones living in New York. So we had a rehearsal space in Greenpoint, and we were going and like, just as we always do, we would just like go in every day and like work on stuff. And then we were just talking about like, you know, we had talked about it before, like not doing it. Then we just kind of decided not to do it anymore. Well, I told him I had the idea to make a kids record. So I told him that. So I would go in some days by myself to work on it, and then he decided to do a record, and then we were like, let's, yeah, Let's just see what happens with that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Personally, did you feel like you had just all these ideas for solo music festering all along, like all these years in the Walkman that you could finally let out?
No, not really. No, it was more like I was so used to going in and writing every day. And I felt like I had, as far as the craft of like writing lyrics and like putting together songs, I felt like I'd done it long enough that I really had that. So I just really wanted to you know, I really wanted to figure out if there's a way I could do it where I was singing, even though I'm a pretty shitty singer. I remembered that a lot of the singers that I like are pretty shitty singers, and I was like, maybe I can just kind of do what they do and just kind of just, you know, be yourself and try to be funny.
Yeah, so you mentioned early interests as the Walkman were still going and doing a kids record, and now you've made a couple. So where does that interest come from?
It comes from, I think I was drawn to it just because it was so different, you know? It just felt like, it felt like the opposite of everything I'd done before, like being in the cool band kind of thing. And there's so much cool involved in being in a band and in rock and roll. And I just felt like I wanted to do something that's sort of profoundly uncool and that's entirely like lyric driven, that without total clarity in all of your words, it doesn't really work. And so it just sort of, you know, it's like, I'm like a record collector, nerd record guy, and I really like, you know, I like tons of stuff, but I really love like 50s music, like Coasters and like Lieber and Stoller kind of music, and I always have. And just listening to that stuff, to me it sounded like if I made music like that, I never planned to make like ABC's kind of like Tie Your Shoelace kind of music. I just thought I could make sort of whimsical 50s kind of music and sing in my normal voice and try to be funny, and that I could call it a kids record. And I was like, that sounds like a great idea. So I did it.
Rattlesnakes. We're not like all the other snakes. Rattlesnakes. We got musical tails that we shake. We shake, shake, shake them while you clap your hands. We don't want to bite you. All we really want to do is dance. All the other snakes don't understand.
On the new album, When Alone on a Solo Australian Tour. That song's awesome. I love that song.
Oh, thanks, yeah.
It's so funny with the back and forth, the dialogue. You did the Barbershop Quartet on the NPR Tiny Desk show. Yeah, take me through that song. Was there really a trip to Australia?
Yes, that's everything in that song is true. I went to Australia by myself. They booked me to play at the Sydney Opera House, play it, like the family day at the Vivid Live Festival, which is like a festival they do every year in Sydney. So I was like, yeah, sure, because they're paying me well. And I was like, great, going to Australia. And I just loved the idea of like just having my stupid, like a guitar and like a bag and like just going by myself. It really seemed like a cartoon. And also at that point, like I had two kids at home, and home is kind of hectic. And I hadn't been on tour for a while. I hadn't like left like New York in a while. And I was like, I mean, honestly, I feel like I'm saying the words to the song because that's what it's about. It's all very true. So I figured it would be nice to just go on a solo mission. And I honestly was really hoping that I could try to write songs while I was gone. I went over there and played played in Melbourne and Brisbane, and then I went to Sydney and played. And I played like solo shows, as I say in the song. Played like solo shows, and they're like very unattended, but there were some people there, and I got some good laughs. So, and then I did the Sydney Opera House show, and it was very comical, because you know they're like life size, like human size, like cockatoos and like weird animals on stage, and I'm just like, what the hell am I doing here? It's just very funny. I honestly could have probably walked off stage during the show, and it wouldn't have affected the concert at all. I had rehearsed with the band. Like, I had a lot of, the song was originally a lot longer because there's a lot of very funny stuff that happened over there. I rehearsed with the band like the day before, and they were, you know, it's like an hour and a half of songs with like a quick rehearsal the day before. So, you know, they were not very well rehearsed. So it was, yeah, it was definitely comical, but I was by myself. So I'm used to being like with the boys, like with the Walkmen, like there's plenty of ridiculous comical stuff that happens and you're always like laughing at each other. But I was just by myself. I was just kind of like, this is just comical. So I would, so when I got home, I sort of wanted just to write about all the funny stuff that happened.
Shows. Well, I was getting the laugh. Did you make any money?
Yeah, I did fine, actually.
Did you make any friends?
Yeah, I did. I met some really great people down there.
Did you write any songs?
Just this one, really.
How was your show at the Sydney Opera House?
Oh, it was great. You know, it was amazing to play there.
Did you have a band?
Yeah, I had a band just for that one show, and all the rest were solo shows.
Did anyone come to your solo shows?
I mean, not really, but I still enjoyed them.
Yeah, and take me through the rest of the experiences that brought you to your newer solo album, the one that came out this year. I guess your family also played a big role in it?
Well, I mean, I did that first Kids record, and it did well for me, you know, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is great. Like, I'm making a living doing this on my own. And then I put out, an album about art history. It was very much in the same vein. And it got good press, but it didn't help me out a ton. but I really liked writing sort of autobiographical stuff. I just never thought I could write autobiographical stuff before. And so I had a song on that art history record about like all the jobs I had when I was younger. And I was excited that I could write something that was actually true and autobiographical and kind of funny. And so I just wanted to do more of that. So I started writing, after I finished that Arts and Leisure record, I started to work on these songs just about being a musician and about, you know, some of it's serious and some of it's about friends, but there's, you know, and I just try to keep it true to life and entertaining. And usually there's something funny idea, even in a serious song, just because that's the way I kind of think, I think.
Yeah. Reminisce Bar and Grill, the name of the album.
Yeah. I just really liked that title. I had actually had that title for a few years, and I was like, it was originally gonna be like a country record. I thought it was such a good name for a country album. But then, like, sitting down actually writing, I'm thinking about doing a country record now. But it didn't end up being a country record. I just like the title. I like how it was sort of nostalgic and sort of, and also funny. I like having the word grill in an album title.
Yeah, that is pretty funny. And I can see the country connection, too.
Yeah.
And amidst all the humor I've read in, like, interviews you've done and just in the lyrics, like, you're musing on the end of life, too, in that album.
Yeah, I just sort of wanted to talk about the things that guys my age think about. And, you know, and I know for just in talking to my friends that stuff, I mean, especially when you have kids, you start to, you know, you start to worry about your health and like dying a lot. I mean, I think that everybody worries about that. And I just, you know, it's sort of, I just wanted to write about it. I thought it would be funny. And about exercising. I wanted to write about my half-assed attempts to exercise. So I have a song about exercising.
What's another good one you think reps the album to drop in for the listeners?
I like the Australian one. I think it's probably my favorite one. The first song is about my friend Mylan, who's a songwriter too. And I get a little complainy about like money stuff and that, which I thought was funny. I like the one "I'm a Puppy." That's like my sort of romantic song. Slow jam.
We'll do that one. "I'm a Puppy."
Okay.
So it had better be true, 'cause I'm a puppy. But that's why you love me.
Yeah, so aside from the new album, what else is going on for you? Because you do music and songwriting for TV and film, right?
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of that in the last year. So I've been very busy with that, and it's great. It's sort of like having a day job. And it allows me to not go on tour, which is the thing that I really love about it. But I also love the process of it. I like writing different kinds of things, and it's all, you know, I have a studio in Gowanus. So I just go there every day and work on, recently I've been doing a ton of that. I've been wanting to work on a new record of my own stuff, because I have a bunch of songs, but I haven't been able to lock it in or even to figure out what kind of record I want to make. But yeah, it's been great. I'm trying to desperately to avoid going on tour, though I'm going to Alaska for a one-off next week, actually.
All right.
Yeah, to Anchorage, to the University of Anchorage. Just kind of like my Australia thing. But I think I've jinxed it with the Australia thing. I'm not going to get a funny song out of the Alaska trip.
Well, let's see what happens.
We'll see.
What is the show like? Tell me about it.
I really don't know. All I know is it's at the University of Alaska in Anchorage. And I've never been there before. And I play at 6:30 p.m.
Very cool. For the listeners, there it is. ticket information, we'll throw that into the description.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting. It sounds like all of this, if you trace your life in music and just, I guess, your life in general, because that's what you do, if you trace it all the way back, it seems like it goes back to that decision to drop out of college and piss off your parents.
I think it does. You know, it was sort of like, I didn't put that much thought into that decision. It's funny. Because I never thought I would do music professionally. Yeah. In like senior year in high school, I remember talking to my friend Stuart about it, the guy who became the Fire Eater singer. And he was like, yeah, we should just do music. And I was like, yeah, we can't just like, what are you talking about? We can't like do music. But I'm glad that I realized that I should do that, because I certainly don't know how to do anything else.
And a bunch of friends that you made in those days seem like they've popped up on your solo albums, like Karen and Nick from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs,
yeah.
Matt from the National.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I actually went to college with Nick. Nick, well, I was only there for a semester at Bard right before we dropped out of school. But I got recruited to be like on the like sort of rock and roll softball team with all the guys who are in bands.
Oh, all right.
And I could actually play baseball, because I was like, I played baseball when I was a kid.
Oh yeah, Nick seems like a total jock.
Yeah, no, Nick was I was a pitcher and Nick was the catcher.
All right, and you got to like be able to do some baseball in order to play catcher.
Yeah, he didn't though. It sounds like something out of a movie, but he had like a camera around his neck and was just like smoking and absent-minded. He was not a very good catcher. We were not a very good team. But that's how I got to know Nick, and then he moved to Brooklyn when I you know, he moved there after school. I guess he moved there in the late 90s, so we became buddies then.
Very cool. I'm trying to see if there's anything else I wanted to touch on. We covered a lot. I mean, do you think the Walkmen could get together and do stuff anytime soon?
I don't think so. I doubt it. You know, I think we all are very much enjoying not doing it. I think everybody's really, I feel like everybody in the, all the five of us are doing sort of, it ever really makes sense what we're all doing. And I think everybody, as far as I can tell, at least they say, is happy in what they're doing. We did it for a long time. I can't imagine doing it again. I especially can't imagine like sitting down and writing songs together again. I think we sort of are out of, it'd be like getting back together with like your girlfriend from high school or something. You know, it's just kind of that chapter is sure. done. But we're all good buddies. You know, I was actually texting with Paul on the way here, and Ham's my cousin, so he and I still live in Brooklyn, so I see him all the time. Yeah, we're a close gang. We just don't want to do music together anymore.
Well, sounds like you guys came out and you're happy now. That's great. I mean, a lot of bands don't end that way.
No, it is nice. I'm proud of that. Yeah, they're good guys. You know, we're all like very like, I don't know, normal, respectful people. at least I think. And so, you know, we're normal and respectful to each other.
Yeah, that was fun. Thank you, Walter. Thank you for the stories. Thank you for coming by. That was a fun hang. I hope you guys enjoyed that one. It's one of those interviews where I just enjoyed so much going into this person's life throughout music and just how different music scenes and different collaborations and all these fun stories have followed them through their life, and seeing where it got Walter to where he is now with the solo music. His new album is called Reminisce Bar and Grill. Came out earlier this year. Go check it out. That very, very funny song about going to Australia is on that album along with a bunch of others, and I think his sense of humor really shines through on that album. We were talking at the top of the show about his old buddy Albert Hammond Jr. from The Strokes on a previous episode. You can hear that conversation on Alternative Facts by searching for the show wherever it is you get your podcasts, iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever you get your shows, wherever you get your podcasts, search for hashtag Alternative Facts. It's all one word. You can find the Albert Hammond Jr. episode and all the other episodes in the archives, and you can also subscribe to the show there. We drop usually at least once a week, sometimes more than once a week, on all different days. Make sure you get every episode automatically by hitting the subscribe button. And also, feedback. Feedback is awesome. Give us a star rating. Write in whatever you like, don't like about the show. It really does help a lot with everything we do at Alternative Facts. My name is Chris Payne. I'm your host with this show every week. You can find me on Twitter at CPayne on a plane. I'm always dropping in little things about what I'm doing at Billboard. I also write for the website and the magazine. But my favorite thing probably is hosting the show. And I'm always giving hints about what's coming next. So until then, I'll catch you next time. Bye, guys.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.